Well, today we are concluding the story of Joseph. We've been talking about Joseph for a long time now. I think it was mid-August when we started this. So we've covered a lot of ground, and today we will conclude. Just want to mention up front that I'm going to try something a little different today. At the end of the service today, if you would like a question and answer time about the story of Joseph, either about today's sermon or something in any of the previous sermons or just something from your own study, stick around. We're going to have just a Q&A time right down here at the front, and that'll be right after the service. So anything about story of Joseph, any questions you've had, whatever, just stick around afterwards and we can talk about it. Just want to quickly catch you up on where we left off last time. The big climactic moment of this whole story occurred when Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers. After all this time, literally, at least a year, maybe 2 years of tricking them and testing them and all the things he put them through, he finally comes to the point where he says, "I am your brother Joseph," and reveals his true identity. Quite a moment. And after that, he gives them lots of gifts, food and clothes and money and so on, and also invites the entire family to move to Egypt. And in fact, Pharaoh also seconds that idea and says, "You guys, your family can have the whole land of Goshen," which was a certain section of Egypt. And then Joseph sends his brothers home, says, "Guys, now go home and tell my dad that I'm alive. Tell him everything that you've seen. Tell him about me." And so the brothers take off. They head back to Canaan to tell their father Jacob. And at first, when they tell him that Joseph is alive and he's the governor of Egypt, Jacob doesn't believe him. "No, there's no way. My son, who was dead for all this time, you're telling me he's not only alive, but he's the governor of Egypt? You know, it's a bit much." But eventually, he's convinced that, in fact, Joseph is alive. And so Jacob is overwhelmed with emotion and makes really a touching statement. He says, "My son is alive, and now I will go see him before I die. This son who all these years was dead to me is now alive. Just to see him again will make my life complete." And so in chapters 46 through 49 of Genesis, which we're going to skip over today, chapters 46 through 49 tell the story of Jacob and all of his family making the journey from Canaan to Egypt and the big reunion that takes place there between Joseph and Jacob, and the family is reunited and it's just this wonderful family celebration. Jacob and his family move out to the land of Goshen, where they make a really good life for themselves. They're very secure out there. Things are good. They make a living for themselves as shepherds, and really all is good for Jacob's family for about a period of 15 to 20 years that they live out there. And then at that point, Jacob is an old man, and he realizes that his final day of life is approaching. And so on his deathbed, he calls his sons to him, all 12 of his sons, calls them to him, and he gives a blessing to each son that is distinct for each person based on their character. And it's a very interesting blessing that he gives. It's in chapter 49, if you want to read it, that really talks about what the future holds for each one of these boys. So he gives them a blessing, and then he also gives instructions. He says, "I want my body to be taken back to Canaan. I don't want to be buried here in Egypt. I want to be buried back in Canaan with my ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and so on. Bury me with them." And so the sons, Joseph, they give their word to their father that they will carry out his final request. And then Jacob dies. And that concludes chapter 49. And so we pick up with the story today in chapter 50, verse 1. "So Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel." So Jacob dies, and and Joseph orders that his father be embalmed. Now, as you probably know, the Egyptians were very famous for embalming the dead. That's why, to this day, we still find mummies in Egyptian tombs, because they would embalm the dead, especially the kings and so on. Now, do you know who did the embalming in ancient Egypt? Who carried out that practice of embalming? It was done by the priests, by the practitioners of the Egyptian religion. Because embalming was not about preserving the body so that you could have a funeral a week later. The purpose of embalming in Egyptian culture was to preserve the body for the life to come. The idea in Egyptian, I guess you would call it theology, was that you needed a body to inhabit in the next world. And so you needed to have your body preserved for the next life. That's why embalming was so important. And it's interesting to note that Jewish theology has a very different view of death, and that is that when you die, you're dead, and your body goes back to the ground. And the idea being that you don't embalm the body because the body needs to go back into the earth. So here you have Jacob, his body being embalmed. And I want to point out, who does the embalming? Joseph directed his physicians to do the embalming, okay? It wasn't the Egyptian priests who did it. In other words, this was not a religious embalming that was taking place of Jacob. It was a, you might say, a functional embalming, so that his body could be preserved long enough to take it back to Canaan and have it buried there. And the text goes out of its way to make it clear this was not an Egyptian religious practice of having Jacob embalmed. This was a functional practice so that they could carry out Jacob's final request of being buried back in Canaan. Excuse me. Verse 2, so the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days. Embalming was not a simple process. 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. When the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, if I have found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me. Tell him, my father made me swear an oath and said, I am about to die. Bury me in the tomb I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Now let me go up and bury my father, then I will return. Commentators point out that in this passage, there are two phrases that lead us to believe that relations between Joseph and Pharaoh have started to deteriorate, which would also mean that relations between the Egyptians and the children of Israel had also started to deteriorate. And the two phrases, the first one is the very last one here on the screen, where Jacob or Joseph says, then I will return. I want to go to Canaan, bury my father, fulfill his request, and then I will return. The question being, why would Joseph have to say, then I will return? Wouldn't that be obvious? Commentators say that it's because it wasn't clear in Pharaoh's mind that in fact Joseph would return. Tensions perhaps have started to develop, and maybe Pharaoh isn't so sure that Joseph is completely committed to Egypt anymore. In fact, maybe he's more committed to his homeland and his home people. And so this is Joseph assuring Pharaoh that in fact he will come back. Okay, it's an idea, we don't know for sure. The other phrase that leads us to believe that maybe relations had deteriorated is in the previous, or the same verse, where it says, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court. In other words, Joseph didn't go speak directly to Pharaoh. And the question is, why wouldn't he? He's number two in command of Egypt. He's spoken to Pharaoh directly in the past. Why isn't he speaking to Pharaoh directly now when he's making a personal request? And again, the idea being that maybe relations have deteriorated so that now Joseph now feels the need to go through an intermediary to make this request. Continuing in verse 6, Pharaoh said, "Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear to do." So Joseph went up to bury his father. All Pharaoh's officials accompanied him, the dignitaries of his court and all the dignitaries of Egypt, besides all the members of Joseph's household and his brothers and those belonging to his father's household. Only their children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very large company of both Israelites and Egyptians. And when they reached the threshing floor of Atad near the Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly. And there Joseph observed a seven-day period of mourning for his father. Joseph observed a seven-day period of mourning for his father. Perhaps some of you are familiar with the term to sit Shiva. The word Shiva is a Hebrew word that simply means seven. So to sit Shiva means to sit seven or to sit for 7 days. And it's a Jewish custom that when someone close to you, an immediate family member, dies, you don't immediately get on with your life. You don't immediately go back to work the next day. You don't immediately get back to your day-to-day responsibilities. You sit for 7 days. You sit Shiva. And what you will do is you will sit in your home, and friends and family will come by and spend time with you. And the way it works is only the person in mourning gets to direct the conversation. The guests who come to console the person in mourning, they don't get to direct the conversation. So in other words, if the person who is mourning wants to talk about the deceased, then everyone talks about the deceased. If the person who is in mourning wants to talk about baseball, they all talk about baseball. If the person in mourning doesn't want to talk at all and they just want to sit in silence, everyone just sits in silence. But it's a period devoted specifically to mourning and to the immediate family members who are in the process of mourning. And it seems to me that there is some wisdom in this custom. It's a custom that obviously goes way back. It goes back to the time of Joseph, probably even before Joseph, and it's still continued to this day, at least among practicing Jews. I happen to think there's some wisdom in taking time after a loss of an immediate family member to say, you know what, I'm not going to be in the office tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I am going to mourn this loss. We have in our culture the idea that the way you deal with death, sometimes the best way to deal with it is just to get on with life. Be tough, be strong, you know, that the stiff upper lip. And I think at least from a psychological standpoint, there is value in saying, no, I'm just going to set aside some time to mourn. I'm not going to stuff it. I'm not going to try to avoid it. I'm just going to deal with it. Anyway, just a thought about that, and clearly that's what Joseph is doing here. He's observing the 7 day, he's sitting Shiva in mourning his father. In the verses that follow, verses 11 through 14, I'm not going to take the time right now to read those out loud, but basically what they talk about is they bury Jacob in Canaan, they honor his request, and then the whole funeral party returns back to Egypt, back to the homeland, where we pick up the story in verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" Okay, it's been somewhere between 15 to 20 years now since Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers. The family has been living, so to speak, happily in Canaan. Everything is good. Or, not in Canaan, in Goshen. They've been living in Goshen for 15 to 20 years. But apparently, All this time, the brothers have had lingering doubt in their mind about how Joseph really looks at them and whether he's really forgiven them for what they did in abandoning him in that pit so many years ago. The question in their mind is, did Joseph really forgive us? Or is he has he just been waiting for Dad to die so that now he can take his revenge? In other words, has he just been showing respect for our father, and now that Dad's out of the way, now Joseph can really pay us back for what we did? That is their fear. That is their concern. And you want to talk about a punishment for these brothers for what they did to Joseph? 15 to 20 years of just living with the anxiety of maybe when our father's dead, Joseph is going to do something really bad to us. I mean, that is punishment in and of itself for what they did. They just don't know for sure if Joseph has forgiven them. And now they're afraid that he's going to get his revenge. Uh-oh, this day that we've dreaded has come. Dad is dead, and now we're done for. Verse 16. So they, the brothers, they sent word to Joseph, saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died." Now notice, the brothers don't go to Joseph in person. They send a message, a messenger. These guys really are scared of Joseph. They don't want to face him in person. And it's interesting what they said. Notice the first two words of their message to Joseph. It is, "Your father left these instructions before he died." Your father. Why didn't they say, "Dad left these instructions before he died"? Why didn't they say, "Our father left these instructions"? No, it's "your father." And it's deliberate. What they're saying is, "Your father, to whom you owe allegiance, Joseph, he left these instructions." Okay? It's very wise on their part. It's like what happens in our house when Devin or Derek misbehave, and I don't want to deal with punishing them. What do I say to Diane? "Your boys did it." Okay? In other words, you're responsible for taking care of it, right? And Joseph, the brothers are basically saying that. Your father, the one who you owe allegiance to, Joseph, he left these instructions before he died. And what are the instructions? Verse 17, "This is what you are to say to Joseph." Now, this is basically Jacob talking now. This is the message from Jacob. "This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now, please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." So they first of all appeal to Joseph on behalf of your father. Now, they also appeal to Joseph on behalf of, look at the very last line there on the screen, of the God of your father. First of all, it's your father. Now it's the God of your father. Not once do they appeal to Joseph on the basis of brotherly love. "Hey, we're your brothers. Treat us well." No, it's your father and the God of your father. Do it because they said. Now, I want to point out something that's important here, and that is that this whole thing is a lie. Jacob did not leave these instructions. Nowhere in the text does it tell us that these were Jacob's instructions to Joseph. The brothers made the whole thing up, okay? In fact, many commentators point out that just based on the text alone, Jacob never knew what the brothers really did to Joseph. In other words, Jacob never knew the full story about Joseph being put in the pit by the brothers and then taken into slavery. So if Jacob never knew the full story about that happening, why would he then say to forgive? He wouldn't. He doesn't even know exactly what happened. And I want to tell you something else that is either interesting or disconcerting or bothersome. You'll have different responses to this. And that is that according to Jewish tradition, in other words, according to the rabbis who taught about this story, the brothers were justified in their lie. In this message they sent to Joseph, making up something their father didn't say, the rabbis taught that the brothers were justified in making that up. And why were the brothers justified? It's because the brothers were trying to keep peace in the family. The term in Hebrew is shem bayit, peace in the home. And the rabbis placed a huge value on peace in the home or peace in the family. And the teaching was that there are some lies that are allowed for the sake of keeping peace in the home. Other lies are not, but for the sake of peace in a home, lies can be allowed. Now, isn't that interesting and maybe disconcerting? But that is what they taught. And so I've been thinking about this, and the thing I wonder is, do we basically on a functional level kind of practice the same thing? That lies are allowed for the sake of keeping peace in the home. And you may have different responses to this, but I've just been thinking about this. A simple example is the one we all know about, honey, does this dress make me look fat? Okay, do you tell the truth or do you keep peace in the home? Which way do you go? Another one would have to do with children and parents. Let's say a child grows up in a home where the parents are very strict Sabbath keepers, and the child is raised that way. The child then grows up, and they make their own home, and they have children, but they're not as strict about keeping Sabbath like the parents are. When the parents come to visit, how much does the child let on about the differences in Sabbath keeping as opposed to the parents? Because the child knows that it would be hurtful, or possibly hurtful, for the parent to know the truth. Is it justified in that situation to keep peace in the home, or is it more important to reveal the truth? Which one do we do? Which way do we go? Another one is, let's say there's Uncle Frank. Everyone in the family loves Uncle Frank. He comes to all the family reunions. He's really outgoing. Everyone loves Uncle Frank. The truth is, in his earlier years, Uncle Frank committed a lot of indiscretions. Does everybody need to know about Uncle Frank's past? What wins out? The truth about Uncle Frank or peace in the home? And I don't have an answer for you. This is not an easy one. But just in thinking about the rabbi's response to this, it's caused me to think about this. Do we on a functional level really practice the same thing? I don't know. Something to think about. Okay, continuing with verse 17. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. When Joseph got this message from his brothers, he wept. Now, why did Joseph cry? Why did he cry at this message? I think it's because it really hurt him to know that all this time his brothers have been carrying this burden, this worry, that they were not forgiven, and that when their dad died, Joseph would pay them back. I think it hurt Joseph deeply to find that out. When all this time, Joseph thought everything was great between them for the last 15 or 20 years, and all of a sudden to find out, oh my goodness, my brothers have been carrying this burden for all this time, and I didn't know. And if I had known, I could have done something about it. I could have lifted this burden for them. I think he cried for that. And I bet some of you have experienced something maybe similar to this, where you have found out that someone has been carrying a burden regarding you. They have thought that you were mad at them. They have thought you didn't forgive them for something. And then you find out later on the truth, that all this time they've been carrying this burden because of what they thought about how you looked at them. And it breaks your heart to think, oh my goodness, all this time I thought things were great between us, and it turns out that they were afraid of me, or they thought I hated them, or they thought I was mad at them. And it breaks your heart to find that out. If only I would have known. I could have done something, but I could have lifted that burden for them. And I think that's what's going on with Joseph. It breaks his heart to find this out. For 20 years, everything was good, and he couldn't lift the burden for them. Verse 18, his brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. So first the brothers sent a messenger, now they come in person. And they bow down in front of him, once again fulfilling the dream that Joseph had had as a 17-year-old boy, that they would all bow down in front of him. Once again, it's happening. And they announce they are prepared to be his slaves because it's better to be his slaves than to die. And especially they want to protect their family. If Joseph just limits his revenge to us, that he won't take revenge on our children and so on. Verse 19, but Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. I mean, this is a beautiful illustration of what forgiveness looks like. He just announces, guys, I already have forgiven you. It's you're fully forgiven. I have no revenge planned. I'm not going to do anything against your children. In fact, I promise you that I will take care of your children. And he reassured them, it's okay. He says he spoke kindly to them and he reassured them. Now, what was the basis of Joseph's forgiveness of his brothers? The basis of Joseph's forgiveness of his brothers was God. Look, he says, am I in the place of God? He says, no, you guys intended to harm me, but God took what was meant for evil and he used it for good. In other words, God had his hand in this whole thing. You know, God engineered the outcome. So how can I hold this against you guys when God had this outcome in mind? How can I hold it against you when there's so much good that's come from? I mean, look, lives have been saved because of this. So guys, it's okay. The result is it's good, and God was in the middle of it. It's okay. I forgive you. Now, according to Jewish tradition, Joseph is given the title of tzaddik. Tzaddik means a righteous man. No one else in Jewish tradition is given this title, where it's actually part of their name. Abraham doesn't have it. Moses doesn't have it. David doesn't have it. Only Joseph has tzaddik, or righteous man, as part of his actual name in the tradition. And the reason is, it's said, it was because of his goodness, and in particular, his goodness to his brothers. And you see it illustrated right here. He could have taken advantage of them. He could have destroyed. They were totally at his mercy. He was the governor of Egypt. And his father's dead, he could have done whatever he wanted with them. Instead, he forgives them, he reassures them, and he speaks kindly to them. In fact, he even cries because of their pain. And so he's called a righteous man, a kind man. Verse 22, Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family, and he lived 110 years. In Egyptian culture, the ideal lifespan was 110 years. Joseph lives 110 years. It's interesting because in Jewish culture, the ideal lifespan is 120 years because Moses lived 120 years. Sometimes a blessing is said, may you live as long a life as Moses, or may you live 120 years. Joseph lives 110 years, because in many ways Joseph is Egyptian. That's where he spends almost all his life. That's where God put him, and that's where he'll die, is in Egypt. Verse 24. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." Now, the language in this text is a little bit odd, because all of a sudden it's talking about Egypt is a place you want to get out of. He's talking about God will come to your aid and take you out of this land, and God's going to get you out of Egypt. Now, Egypt has been a great place. Egypt has sustained them. It's a place where they've had food and they've had clothes and they've had a good life. And what we really have here is a red flag about what is about to come. That Egypt, the wonderful place for the children of Israel, is all of a sudden going to turn into a land of slavery. We're literally just verses away from the story of Exodus. And so you have, in the words of Joseph, the warning of things are about to change. But God will deliver you. God will get you out of this land and take you back to the land that he promised you. And also Joseph says, and when God delivers you, you must take my bones as well. I don't want to be buried in Egypt either. I too want to be buried in the promised land in Canaan. So verse 26, so Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Coffin in Egypt. Egypt, the land where he was taken as a slave, the land where God did a wonderful thing through him, the land where God saved who knows how many lives, the land where Joseph's family's life was saved from, and also the land where the children of Israel, the descendants of Joseph, will become enslaved, which is what Exodus is all about. But at this point, we have reached the conclusion of Joseph's life and Joseph's story. So if you have any questions or comments and you want to stick around afterwards, please join me down here in front. Otherwise, let's close with prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for the story of Joseph that shows how you work in very mysterious ways, and how you take very ordinary, common people just like us and do good. And Lord, we're thankful that you can take even the things that are meant for evil in our lives and use them for good. And so we offer up our lives for that purpose. Any way that you can make a Joseph story out of our lives, we allow you to do just that. We pray in Jesus' name, amen.